The SBA loan, if you have a business, which you should have open for 2 years. So I recommend all residents and their after their intern year, go ahead and start an LLC. It's free. And it's really easy to get a loan to start a business as a physician. It really is. So we did that. And when we finished the center, we were just able to expand and see so many more patients. We went from seeing 30 to 40 patients a day to seeing 100 to 120 patients a day because we were allowed to park more patients. We were allowed to schedule more patients. We were able to bring more physicians on board and mid-levels. So it really allowed us to scale the operation.
Welcome to Skin Deep. I'm Dr. Anna Chacon, and today we have a very special guest joining us. Get ready for some expert insights you won't want to miss.
Tell me a little bit about where you grew up, your background, your parents, where you're from.
So grew up in Miami, Florida. Parents are Cuban descent, migrated here in 1962 after communist Fidel Castro took over. It moved up to Chicago because there was jobs there. And then, of course, it snows in Chicago. And Miami is more amenable to that climate, that tropical climate. So they made their ways back down to Miami. My mom is a human resource director, nothing to do with medicine. And then my dad is a mechanic, auto mechanic. So I got love for cars and learned early on how to be like a business / computer geek.
Yeah.
Went to high school in Miami and then
I
went to high school in South Miami High, and then I transferred to American High. I lived with my grandparents for about a year and a half on my dad's side. My grandfather, interestingly, was part of the Cuban Revolution until Fidel decided to become a communist. So living in that household gave me a lot of military bearing.
All right. And then talk a little bit about your trajectory into medicine, because you're really young. You know, you're a practice owner, probably one of the youngest that I know that has several practices and is a residency program director. How did you make that trajectory? Did you know from when you were young that you wanted to be a doctor? Anyone else in your family in medicine? What was your path like?
So my dad is a car doctor, as we lovingly say, and he had a business. So my brother and I in the summers would be there pretendingly filling the cars with gas, you know, cleaning the windshields. But no, nobody in my family is in medicine. I started when I was 14 years, actually when I was 16 years old, I got a job in the emergency room. My mom was the HR director for the hospital, and I was just an orderly, just transferring patients from the ER to x-rays to get their x-rays and then bringing them back, or if they were admitted, I'd take them up to the hospital. It was just cool. 16, 17 years old, seeing code blues, heparin drips, you know, IV antibiotics, starting an IV line, chest compressions. It was just kind of a neat experience because that was my junior year of high school. So I worked Saturdays and Sundays. Interestingly enough, I worked 16 hours on Saturdays and 12 hours on Sunday, but I fell in love with medicine there. And then I had some colleagues who had gone into the Navy, and that's kind of what led me into the Navy. I tried to go to the Marine Corps, but Marine Corps don't have medicine. And then I ended up going to the Navy because they have like a medical corps. I was working two jobs and, you know, college was difficult when you're working two jobs, doing your homework and stuff like that. So I decided to go to the Navy so they can pay for college. I didn't realize I was going to be deployed.
Wow. Where did you go to school and what jobs did you have in college?
When I was in the Navy, I was aboard the USS George Washington. That's actually where I learned how to run a clinic when I was on the ship. It's an aircraft carrier. It serviced 6,300 soldiers and sailors. While I was there, I started teaching x-rays at a local community college. So that's kind of like my teaching thing. That's where I kind of figured, well, okay, I like teaching. And then I would go to school. Like I would take a Saturday class on the ship. When you're deployed, you're allowed to take college classes as well. So I have a funny transcript. I have they would fly the professors out to the ship and we would do classes on board the ship while you were deployed. So that's what I did. You couldn't take any basic sciences. Obviously you would take your English and your English and your math. That's how I kind of did I did my associate's in arts while I was in the Navy. And then I got out of the Navy on Friday and I started nursing school on Monday. I had to meet with my CO and request permission to get out 3 months earlier just so I can fall in line with the nursing school. I went to nursing school at Jacksonville University in Jacksonville, Florida.
I didn't know that you went to nursing school. Wow.
Yeah.
or the Navy, you kind of have nine lives.
I like to stay busy. It was just interesting. You know, it was an interesting path through medicine, and I like traveling, and nursing to me was the next step. I actually had applied for a Navy program. And I remember during the interview, the captain was saying, well, so Dr. Diaz, or so Petty Officer Diaz at that time, what do you think the Nurse Corps officer is going to say when they hear you say you're using nursing as a jumping board to become a doctor? So that interview didn't go very well. I always wanted to be a doctor. I just didn't know how the path to get there. So nursing gave me a job, gave me a great salary, and it was a great backup. I was always taught you got to have a backup plan.
Yeah.
Because if something goes awry.
Especially being Cuban, my dad's Cuban. So your kind of backups are hammered in.
Yeah. And it's funny, when I got my nursing degree, I was so proud. I took it to my grandparents, and my grandfather, I'll never forget this. He says, okay, so when are you going to medical school? He never said congratulations. Yeah. He never said, wow. You know, it was just that kind of drive to keep pushing, you know, going forward. Yeah.
It's interesting because I had the opposite. They were like, you need to go to nursing school. You cannot go to medical school. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I had that. I think just, you know, being a female and stuff, they were not like pushing me towards nursing.
That's kind of old school. I've heard other female physicians say the same thing. That is kind of an old school kind of thought process, right? Especially like, depend on your culture, right?
Yeah.
You know?
No, trust me, I'm almost 40 and without kids. And that's like seen as a huge disappointment. So,
but I think, you know, some of our younger colleagues, right, what they're doing is they're freezing their eggs.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Waiting for the right partner. And I mean, using technology to their advantage. I mean, how many actresses do we know in their mid 40s have kids?
Yeah, correct. And then tell me, so that's really interesting. I hadn't known that about you. That's a lot to accomplish. And I'm very close to my grandparents too. I actually still live with my grandma.
Yeah, no, that's cool.
I'm not embarrassed about it because, I mean, I spent so many years, I'm sure you did, working by yourself or studying by yourself. And I actually want to be with my family as much as I can. You know, it's every minute, even if it means living under the same roof, that's great.
It's how you got to where you are. Right.
Right.
Those values that they instilled in you. And then obviously coming home after a bad day, for sure. They see the world with a different lens, you know?
Right. Right. Correct. And then tell me a little bit about starting your practice, where you made the transition from medical school. What did you do after that? What did you do after medical school? And basically how you got to starting your practice.
Yeah. So medical school, I'm a foreign grad. I went to medical school in the Dominican Republic. Again, it was $13,000 a semester. For me, it was a no-brainer to go there. I sold my house at the height of 2006, made great money, and used some of that money to fund my college.
It was
amazing. I didn't realize how great of an experience it was going to be because you get a lot of hands-on training in foreign schools. I did teach at the University of Miami. And I get a lot of medical schools from them and medical students from them. And it's kind of interesting, honestly, unfortunately, the lack of exposure sometimes they get just because of all the restrictions. When you're in a third world country training, there are no restrictions. It's really a great experience. But so I graduated from med school and didn't realize it was a little challenged getting into residency spots. I took my steps, passed them all. I did well in them. And it was kind of like I wasn't getting all these interviews that I was expecting. I'm a man of faith, and I think that God put me in the right place. He put me in a residency program in Alabama. And of course, I wanted to be at the Cleveland Clinic. I wanted to be where I interviewed. I wanted to be at some of the other bigger names, but I didn't realize how awesome it was to be in an unopposed family medicine residency program. My program was amazing. My program director was a surgeon who then was doing family medicine. I had a family medicine OB doctor. I had a family medicine dermatology doctor. And wow. I had two family medicine who were like inpatient gurus. So my training was really broad and diverse from central lines to chest tubes. My dermatology training, I love dermatology. I actually did almost 5 months of electives in it, but I trained with a Mohs surgeon and his wife was a dermatologist. So just did so many procedures that led me into my private practice. I didn't realize I was going to be in the Florida Keys. My path was like, okay, I'm going to be an emergency room doctor because I've always been in the emergency room. I was, you know, 16, 17 when I started in the ER. Fun fact, I got to go back as a nurse and work in the same ER that I was, you know, an orderly in. And then I got to go back and work as an ER doctor in that same ER. So it was kind of cool. Believe it or not, there were still some employees that knew me from that time. And what I saw was is it was like nothing against ER medicine, but it was just a path of like you work, you get paid, and then you go home, but you're really not building anything. So I had an opportunity to interview with a doctor who I was his nurse in the ER, and he was partner with the clinic that I bought into. And he said, hey, you know, you should come down here and work with us down in the Keys. By the time you finish with residency, I'll be retiring and you could just step into this place. And it was an amazing opportunity. And funny enough, how life, you know, is, he passed away from the flu virus.
Wow.
And his partner ended up later on reaching out to me and having me come down. So that's how I started my practice. I was working on Mondays at the ER doing 24-hour shifts. And then on Wednesdays and Thursdays, I was working at the clinic. And then the ER allowed me to get money so I can pay bills, you know, because we all have bills when we graduate residency, as you know. And then the business, even though it wasn't making money, it was an investment. It was an investment into something else, you know, something that was mine. That's how I ended up getting into that.
Wow, that's awesome. That's really great. I remember when we first met, you mentioned you're very big on family, you know, despite working a lot, building so many things, traveling here and there, going to Alabama, Dominican Republic, the Navy. You have a pretty good sized nuclear family. How did you meet your wife, who I think you told me was also a physician?
So my wife was my neighbor. She lived across the hallway from me when I was going to school in the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we had the same class together. We actually took the same suture course together. But, you know, I was focused on school. She was focused on school. And we just kept crossing paths. And her father came over and asked me for water. And that's kind of how our friendship really started. He was visiting his daughter. And he knocked on my door. And that's kind of how we started just talking from there. So we met in medical school. And she's not practicing. We have five beautiful children. But she runs the business. Fun fact, when we started the business, you know, because she had sacrificed her residency and her career, all the businesses were under her name. So, you know, we have a family joke that if I ever misbehave, she owns everything.
That's funny. Did you adopt kids as well?
No, we never got to. We wanted to. We had a child that was born in residency. And I don't know if you know this or not, but you got to have like $25,000, $28,000 to adopt a kid in the U.S.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, it's become like, it's almost like an industry, right? Adoption. Yeah.
I was her OB through her pregnancy and she didn't want the child. And she was like, you know, you'd be great. And I was like, well, this would be great. Talk to my wife. She was on board with it. But I mean, as a second year resident who has $25,000.
Wow. Crazy. Yeah. And tell me a little bit about how you bought the practice in the Keys. Yeah, you talked a little bit about that, but I remember you told me, you know, and you mentioned the nurse. How did that go? Because now it's pretty hard to do the same thing. Find a practice for that amount in that great of an area.
What I would say for those who have listened this far is there's always a way. You just have to figure it out. You know, we're not inventing a car or a spaceship. At the end of the day, you're still dealing with people. So Dr. Ginsberg, who I bought the practice from, had been practicing for 40 years. So basically he said, hey, you come here, you start your own clinic, your business, and you just work with me in my practice. Okay. My business name is Agape MD LLC, doing business as Isla Morada Medical Center. It was ASAP Urgent Care at that time. I really didn't like ASAP Urgent Care. So I added ASAP Urgent Care and Family Medicine. And basically, he paid half and I paid half of the expenses. So remember, when I started, I was working as an ER. So now I had rent and I had light and Wi-Fi and all that stuff, but I also had some business expenses. He gave me 3 months. He said, okay, for 3 months, you won't have to pay me anything because it takes that long time. From the time you see your first patient to the time you start getting paid, there's a little lapse. You know, Medicare will pay you within 7 to 14 days after seeing that patient. Mm-hmm. But Blue Cross Blue Shield might take, now they're a little bit better than they were back then. They are paying between 14 to 28 days. And then you have your other insurances that may take that long. So after about 3 months, I had enough money to cover the expenses. Our expenses at that time was $10,000 a month for him and $10,000 a month for me, which was really good. We had one front desk, one medical assistant, and one office manager. and we had rent. Our office rent at that time was $3,000 a month, which is unheard of.
Unheard, yeah. And,
yeah. That's right. Yeah. And all the business owners start laughing, right? But it was 1,000 square feet. We had one bathroom. We only had 4 exam rooms. It was a very small office. I shared an office with him, which was kind of hard because I'm a kind of a neat freak, and he wasn't. And it's just one of those sacrifices that you just say, hey, this is a stepping stone. I'm going to start here. And I'll be honest with you, you know, the most money I ever made in practice was in that office because my overhead was so low, you know, and that's one of the things that he taught me is, one, you don't need an MBA to become a business owner. That's actually silly. You know, you think about the time you spend in that education process losing money. It's just really simple. Don't spend more than what you make. And when you make extra money, invest it. Invest it back into the business. And that's exactly what we did. We didn't have the latest technology when it comes to exam tables. Our exam tables are manual. The plus side is there's nothing to break with a manual exam table. And then really, what else do you need? You need an endoscope, an ophthalmoscope, and some surgical instruments, which he had tons of. And you know, all the nuts and bolts to be successful were there. You know, good customer service, being available, answering your phone, answering your email, being there for your patients. The ER was a very good sounding board for me because a lot of patients would come into the ER and not have a doctor. I was just reading an article saying the ER is becoming a new primary care office just because so many people go to the emergency room. And if you give good service and you're respectful and you take time and you explain comorbid conditions with patients and medications, they like you because not many people do that. And as a result of that, people would say, hey, do you have a practice? And of course, for those of us who work in the hospital industry, you know, you're not supposed to self-refer. So I would say, yes, I have a practice, but it's unethical for me to auto-refer. But, you know, Google's free for everybody. And of course, people would Google me, I would come up and they would come see me in the office. And that was a great way to grow my business. And honestly, I didn't go into it knowing that that was going to happen. It just happened organically, and it was really good. So that was how I bought the practice. I would say, like, if I had somebody right now today, we have 4 different sites, and they say, hey, Dr. Diaz, I want to come work with you, but I want to be my own business. I would say 2 things. I'd say, I'll let you buy into the practice, or you can start your own business and come join my practice. Because for those of us in business, understand that most doctors come work at a place and leave after 2 years. You know, very rarely do you see the physician that will come and work with you and be with you for 10, 15, 20 years, which really is a travesty for the young physicians. Because if you're going to be wealthy, you know, you're not chasing the money, but you do want some financial security at some point in your life, especially for us physicians. I mean, some of us are starting in our 28s and our 38s, which for me, by the way, I was 38 when I finished. So I really need to get things going.
How old are you now?
You look 47.
You look 38.
Take it back. Thank you.
Yeah, I also felt super old too, and with no savings when I ended.
Yeah. Right. Which is what I'm saying to young physicians out there is like, look, having your own business, and I do this with all my residents, right? Yeah. So there's 3 factors to a physician. And I draw a physician, and then I draw a physician in a house missing a roof. And then I draw a physician in a house with a roof. The physician is the physician who graduates residency program. We're all that.
Yeah.
The physician in the house is the guy who says, I'm going to open my own clinic, but rents his office space. And then the physician in the house with the roof is the guy that says, you know what, I'm going to buy the building, own the clinic, and be a physician. That physician is much more better off long term. It is tough because you're still sacrificing. You know, I still drove my Honda Civic to the emergency room, right? You pull up to the emergency room parking lot, you park in the doctor's parking, and everybody's got a Porsche. I had the Honda Civic, but that was a sacrifice I was willing to make to start my practice. And that's really what it takes to become wealthy. Is a lot of little sacrifices along the way to get that financial wealth over the long term. But it is possible. It's just a matter of crafting ideas. There's a lot of physicians out there. I believe it's 40% now of primary, or no, 40% of physicians still own their practices, which is down from 60% in 2015. It's a lot of mumbo jumbo with insurances and collections and all that other stuff. The reimbursements have gone down significantly. I get paid significantly less now than I did when I practiced, or, you know, was practicing in 2015. Obviously, I still practice.
It's like a decline.
Absolutely, for sure. Yeah. And there's a bunch of gimmicks. You know, I remember my happiest time of being a physician owner was when I was on paper. Paper would cost me $400 a month. Paper was, I saw the patient finish the chart in the room, take this to the front desk, I'd hand it to them and they would go up to the front desk and I was done with charting on to the next patient. I was able to see anywhere between 30 to 40 patients. That was in 2015. In 2017, I was like, well, at some point I'm going to want to sell this corporation, right? I was thinking to the future. So going to an EHR was inevitable. But as soon as I did that, I could no longer see 30 to 40 patients because the charting was just unbearable. And whether you're dictating or whether you're using AI, nothing is better than paper, because paper, you finished. When you walk out of the room, you're done. With AI and with dictating, you still have to go back and touch the chart again, you know, unless you're touching the chart in the room. And patients don't like when you're doing that. They don't want to see you playing with the computer. They want the visit to be about them.
Yeah. I was going to say, I use AI now and it's on Doximity. It's a button. You press it. I don't know if you've used it. You press, I think I sent you a text about it. You press the button and you focus on the patient and it actually drafts the whole SOAP note, the entire thing. The only thing is it doesn't have eyes, so it can't see the physical exam and it won't add things like, unless you say them out loud, the indications and side effects, you know what I mean? Like things that just have to go in there. But what I notice is they keep demanding more and more and more. So we have these tools that are supposed to make it easier, but then that's not enough because they look at your note and they say, well, where's this? Well, where's that? You know, medical legally, you have to have the indications and side effects. You have to have a physical exam. And then it turns into this novel. You know what I mean? It's just, right. It turns into a novel. But something is better than nothing. And why do you think the, you know, we all know that the ratio or percentage of doctors owning their practice is shrinking and shrinking every year. And personally, I feel as a practice owner myself that they just make it harder. You know, besides the declining reimbursement, it's requirements. It's sometimes you feel like you're not as protected as people in a hospital. You have to pay for everything yourself, legal expenses, this, that. I even feel that way if there's a problem. Like the boards actually think that doctors that work for places like Cleveland Clinic, I was at the Cleveland Clinic, they kind of view it as better than a doctor who's in private practice on their own. You know what I mean?
I think it depends. I actually believe that if you work for a hospital system, you're much more vulnerable than I am. I also believe that your quality of life, your work life, your balance is worse off than mine. I get to dictate what hours I go to work and what hours I come home. I haven't worked a Sunday since I started working because Sundays aren't important for me. It's the Sabbath and I like to go to church with my family. I directly get to decide that. When I started working with the ER, I was represented by my business and I said, look, I'm never going to work a Sunday. That doesn't work for you. Okay, great. I won't go to work. Furthermore, who's going to fire me? Now, do you need to be creative? Of course. You know, do the chart requirements change? Of course. So I read books and I update my templates and I make sure that they coincide. I have an attorney who I meet with on a regular basis, but I get control. The people around me work for me. I don't work for them. You know, there's no security in the hospital. There's no security working for somebody else. The moment you don't meet their needs, you're gone. And to me, that's far worse because, like, let's say you're working for a hospital and your RVUs aren't high enough, right? If you're a surgeon or you're a neurosurgeon, a friend of mine, I understand, got let go because he wasn't doing as many surgeries because he was a great neurosurgeon, right? And I used him because
he just didn't see the need and it was his clinical judgment that interfered.
Exactly. So he's gone now, right? Okay, boom, you're gone. Well, you still have to pay your mortgage. You still have to pay your car payment. So now you go to another job. Well, it takes 3 to 6 months for you to get credentialed.
Yeah.
You know, at the institution and the insurance companies and so forth. So for me, that is far more risky and concerning. You know, with me, I have a direct control over my destiny. And I think physicians don't understand that. I mean, if you have a recruiter telling you how great it is to work for the hospital, I don't recruit. You know, you come to know about me through a podcast or if you're in my residency program. That's, I think, the difference for us. You know, you're asking why. I always say, like, gosh, you know, you made it through undergrad, you made it through medical school, you made it through residency. You can make it through private business. It's so much easier, in my opinion, to your point.
Than operating on somebody's brain. And
Exactly. I mean, you know, you have a septic patient, you know, who's crashing and you're worried about, you know, business when really it goes back to the basics. Don't spend more than you make. And it's just, I know it sounds, you know, cliche and it sounds simple, but it really is that. I mean, being a business owner, and I'm sure you can attest to that, you're just a steward of money. Money comes in, money comes out, right? It's no different. when you have a little extra money, you kind of put it away for a nest egg and you invest the rest. That's your whole career. Because the thing is the more money you make, it becomes more of a problem because now you have taxes, right?
Absolutely.
So, and that's where your write-offs come. So, you know, you say, well, you have all these clinics. Well, you kind of have to have the clinics because you need to keep spending money. Otherwise, you're going to pay taxes. So in business, you have a choice. You either invest it into a depreciating asset like a building or turn a new laser
equipment.
And you depreciate that asset, right? Mm-hmm. So you pay less taxes or you pay more taxes. You know, with the hospital employed physician or the group employed physician or the physicians working at a federally qualified healthcare center, you're a W-2 employee. You're not making as much money. I mean, it sounds good on paper, but when you get a bonus, it's taxed at 40%, and you're paying taxes at 35%. You know, we pay less taxes than that on our income and our gross because we're depreciating our asset. And to me, that is more of a trajectory towards wealth than being an employed physician.
Yeah. Well, hospitals don't pay taxes. That's another unfair part. You know, I have the University of Miami. They have a dermatology clinic actually across the street. And even though they look like a clinic, just like mine, they get paid a hospital facility fee. You know, they have horrible reviews. I have 5-star reviews, over 800. They have horrible reviews and they're making at least twice as much money. You know, Medicare, they dropped again, I think 2.9% this year, but not for hospitals. So they only drop for doctors. They do not drop for hospitals. They actually go up.
That's because we don't have the lobby, correct? So to your point, if you came to Isla Mirada Medical Center and you got a chest x-ray, we charge $99, right?
Yeah.
And we do that because if I billed it through the insurance would pay me $25 for a chest x-ray. So if I take cash, I don't take insurance for my x-rays. If you went to the hospital, depending on what your deductible is for diagnostics, you may be paying $250 to $300 and the hospital's bill for an x-ray is $350. Not fair. And there's tons of data that shows, hey, if we have physician-owned primary care centers, in my case, it drives down the cost of healthcare. Whereas having a hospital drives the cost up.
Right.
But again, you and I don't have, you know, multi-millions of dollars lobbying, you know, in Tallahassee or Capitol Hill to kind of state that fact.
Which they don't. Yeah.
It truly is. And then they go under the ruse that they're not profit. And, you know, one of our local hospital systems has a surplus of $500 million. They're one of the largest employers in the state of Florida. You know, you really use your autonomy as a physician when you're working in an organization like that. I remember during COVID, you know, nobody was trying anything outside the box. Everybody was following that one algorithm. You know, at the end of the day, we're clinicians, right? And we all have a different thought process. What works for me in the Keys may not work for me in my Miami office. So you want to treat your patients based on their comorbid conditions and as an individual. At a hospital institution, you're not doing that. Everybody gets the same rubber stamp. You know, by and large. So there's something to be said about individuality, and it definitely helps the patients. And I compete with a large hospital system, and I also compete with a federally qualified healthcare center. And our office has always surpassed them. And that wasn't something that I set out to do, but it's the quality that we provide. And I think we're able to provide that quality because we can individualize your care when you come see us.
Excellent. Awesome. And then tell me a little bit about how you got into that role of family medicine program director, because that's awesome. You know, you're not just managing the business, but now you're in education and teaching and giving back.
I will say, being a physician, there's a fund called SBA funding, and it's very easy to get SBA funding. When I started my practice, as I told you, I was working in the ER, so I didn't get any funding. What I did was I would pay Dr. Ginsburg $2,000 a month as I was purchasing his practice. When I bought my first building, I went and got an SBA loan to include the purchase of the building and the build out of the building. The way I did it was I was renting a portion of the building to attorneys while I was building out my clinic. I wanted a new clinic. I wanted new doors. I wanted that, you know, new air conditioning. I wanted a center that made sense, that flowed well, because I felt like it was going to take me to that next level. And honestly, I copied a lot of what my residency program had and just centers that I had seen before. But the SBA loan, if you have a business, which you should have open for 2 years, so I recommend all residents in their, after their intern year, go ahead and start an LLC. It's free. If you go online, you can start an LLC
Sunbiz.
Don't worry. Yeah, don't worry about the name. Just get a name and you can change it by doing business as. Because when you go for a loan, they'll require the business to be open for 2 years. It's really easy to get a loan to start a business as a physician. It really is. And so we did that. And when we finished the center, we were just able to expand and see so many more patients. We went from seeing 30 to 40 patients a day to seeing 100 to 120 patients a day because we were allowed to park more patients. We were allowed to schedule more patients. We were able to bring more physicians on board and mid-levels. So it really allowed us to scale the operation with that investment. So again, if you're a physician looking in business, SBA, we used Live Oak Bank. They were very good to us. And I want to just tell everybody that I did that 11 months out of residency. I went for a loan and got approved just because I'm very transparent. We bought the building for $1.5 million. They gave us a loan for $2.6 million. We ended up using $700,000 to redo the whole building.
Wow.
It was completely worth it and completely affordable. Your first year, you're paying just interest because the bank wants you to succeed. And then after that, you were paying, you know, the mortgage. Of course, my operating expense went up, but since I had been in business and I was seeing patients, it kind of went up. It leveled out, exactly.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Yeah, I actually never took out a loan, and that's why I've been scraping by. I'm probably the only dermatologist that's done a laser fellowship without owning a laser yet. But yeah, but that's nice to know.
Could I say something about that? Maybe it's because we're coming from our cultural background. I also was taught not to borrow money.
Yeah.
And what happens is, as you're a business owner, you'll transition your thought process, right? Because you'll see, if you think about major corporations, what do? They borrow money.
Right. Even
they
Amazon.
Borrow money. That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. So borrowing money is actually wise because it doesn't mess with your cash flow, because you always have to have cash flow in a business. So borrowing money with good interest rates allows you to write some of that off, some of the interest off. So there's some tax benefits to that. But you don't want to mess with the mothership, you know. You want the mothership to continually making money so you can continue making payroll and so on and so forth. So it took me a while to digest that, for sure, because I remember early on it was very tough. But then I started just doing more reading. YouTube was very helpful for me. Understanding what YouTube and X, Tesla, and all them big companies do made it make more sense. So taking on debt to make more money makes sense. So for instance, you know, you and I don't know if you have student loans. I could have paid off my student loans 3 times already. I chose not to. I chose to take that money and invest it into commercial properties, real estate properties. And obviously those real estate properties have gone up exponentially over the last 10 years. Meanwhile, my school loans are still there. But when you look at all the money that I've made from those investments, it was much more smarter for me to borrow money because it allowed me to scale, right?
Right. At a much, much greater percentage.
Yeah. And then you'll change, because now where I'm at in my life, now I'm like, okay, now I want to start going this way as far as my debt, right? Because I'm making more money and my assets have gone up. I have more wealth. And just because of my brain, right? Some major investors, they'll say, okay, keep borrowing and keep, I'm kind of risk adverse, and most physicians are risk adverse. Right. So now my mindset is changing. You know, I'm not buying major commercial real estate properties anymore. Now I'm trying to increase my cash flow so I can stay home more.
And what other things? Okay, so getting and starting the family medicine residency program.
So I would encourage everybody, once you graduate residency, become a teacher, even if they don't pay you. You're going to do tons of things in your life for free. Just continue doing it. It's the right thing to do. Dr. Ginsberg had University of Miami and Florida State University medical students coming to the clinic. You know, we're in a unique place. We're in a rural setting, and we're in an island. So the students like to come down and see some of our rural stuff. We got really some cool, you know, fish hooks, shark bites, fish bites, osteomyelitis, some really neat things that we see in our clinic. So I continued to do that. And what I didn't realize is that was giving me experience in the medical education space. So for you to do anything with a residency program, you need to have, you know, 2 to 3 years of training and education under your belt. And as I was building the center, a friend of mine who we went to med school, he was at a residency program. He was, you know, just going and doing rotations with me because we were comfortable with each other. And he was seeing the surgeries that I was doing. And he's like, you know, you'd be a great teacher. And I was like, yeah, you know, I've always wanted to teach. It's just been very difficult I actually wanted to teach with one of the local universities, but kind of difficult because they like to keep to their own. And then there was just an opportunity to reach out to a private hospital who had their residency program. And of course, at this time, I had built a new building. It was 3,200 square feet, completely remodeled. And I had tons of space for, you know, attendings, residents, and then the nursing staff, ancillary staff. And so that's kind of how that started. I started off with a rotation, and then I became a faculty member. Then I moved up to associate program director, and then ended up as a program director. That was just kind of through the process of doing it. I absolutely love it. If you ask me one thing that I actually love in medicine, is I love being a family medicine program director. It's actually one of my passions.
And then last but not least, talk about selling your practice. I think that you were thinking about that. I also want to know how you scaled from one clinic to four, because I actually forgot that you had four. That is a lot.
Well, so, you know, we talked about seeing 100 to 120 patients. When you're seeing that many patients, you start like, okay, where are you coming from? And we had patients coming from a county over. We had patients driving from an hour. We had patients driving from 2 hours over. And then it just made sense, of course, through the process of, you know, furthering my investments to buy another commercial real estate property and then renting it. And then, okay, we could put a clinic there. And then you put a clinic there. And then you start seeing patients. And then it just starts. You go one day and then you needed 2 days and then you needed. So now you have two clinics. In Miami, there's much more Medicare Advantage patients. And I wanted to kind of get into that space.
I actually don't even understand what Medicare Advantage is, to be honest.
Very simply, it's a great question. I didn't either. Basically, the federal government pays you, let's say, $1,000 a month. It's more, but let's say it's $1,000 a month per Medicare life that you manage. Now, if you do a good job managing that Medicare life, i.e., they're not hospitalized, they did their colonoscopy, they've gotten their, you know, their mammography, they've gotten all their quality measures done, and they're healthy, there's going to be some extra money at the end of the year left over because they're healthy. And you had something to do with that. You get some of that money back. Now, if you think, you know, for one patient, you may get back $3,000. Well, if you had 500 patients, you could see where it starts to scale. The other thing is I wanted to have another location for my residents to rotate in Miami because my office is about an hour and a half drive from the hospital. So that was another reason. It was an opportunity to open up another business. So that business, it has a separate TIN number. It's a separate corporation. So I wanted to expand. I was thinking, hey, you know, if a hurricane comes and wipes out my business and they, you know, and my keys, I still have something else.
Now that you see the fires in Los Angeles, that is a very real problem for some people.
Right.
That's a very valid concern with weather.
Right.
Yeah. Things like that. Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, there's a saying, you know, the hardest thing to do is make your first million. And that's so true. Like, you know, with my second and my third clinic, I already know what works and what doesn't work. I have templates already for all the patient visits. I have the EHR. I have the way to collect money. I have the way to go after those who owe us money. It's just so much easier. I know what phone system to use to open up another business. So it's just kind of like progression. I will say that for those physicians listening, you know, it's easier to be successful if you go into an area that there's not a lot of other.
Right.
And this is not earth-shattering information, right? If you open up, if you put a McDonald's where there's no restaurants, guess what? You're going to be successful.
That's the problem with dermatology too in Miami. I think I told you this is the most saturated place in the United States. For physicians, I think too, you know, worst insurance, reimbursements, all that. Medicare is the worst here. Oklahoma, Alaska, even nurse practitioners are doing better than I am in the derm space.
Yeah. But, and there's some to that. What I would say to you, for those of you, you know, young physicians listening, is like, okay, well, I live an hour away from a major metropolitan city. I can go to football games, hockey games. I got a major airport. So I wouldn't necessarily, you know, move out to Alaska. But maybe you open up a clinic that's an hour outside of that city. Obviously, your homes are going to be cheaper. You know, your a building is going to be cheaper. And who knows, if you project it out, what do cities do? They grow. So in 10, 20 years, it's going to grow outward. And you're going to be in that space for 10 to 20 years. You're pretty much guaranteed success, right?
Yeah.
Because our population, you know, and cities are growing. So I think it's really easy to do it.
Okay, awesome. And then I think talk about your, I don't want to say your exit because you're so young, but selling your practice and how that is coming about or what you're thinking about.
Sure. I have the same financial manager that I've had since 2012. And I remember him saying, you know, once you get all the money and you buy all the stuff, what else is there? Same thing happens in business. Like once you have the financial security, you're really fighting for time with your family. Even you know, with this podcast, I'm driving to the stadium because now I'm the assistant coach for the kids, you know, football team. You're just fighting for that time. So it'll come a point in your career, and this is the advantage of having your business, where you'll want to take some chips off the table. You'll want to reduce your risk, right? Like we said, you know, hurricane comes, wipes out the business. Right now, I'm holding all the chips. However, if I let somebody buy into my business, say 80%, 90%, they're going to pay me the value of 90% of those, of what they're called units of my business. I'm going to cash in some of those chips. And that's where the fun begins, right? You know, you can't just put that money in a bank account. You got to reinvest that money. So obviously I like doing that, but it allows you to then go ahead and pay off your school loans, maybe pay off your mortgage of your house, maybe buy a, you know, your second or third home, maybe buy an airplane or whatever it is that you like to do. It gives you just so much leverage. So that's kind of our exit strategy now, just decrease the risk. Still be a business owner, you know, we'll still retain asset in the business. But the advantage is okay, we'll take that money and pay off the commercial real estate property, right? So if I pay off the commercial real estate property with the monies in my house, well, now I have another passive income stream that I didn't have before. And your stress levels just continuously come down. And that's kind of where I'm telling you, it depends on where you're at in life. As you get older, you'll want to do those things.
Pretty high.
If you're younger, you might say, okay, I'm going to take that money and buy another business or buy another commercial. And that may be fine for you, depending where you're at. But for me right now, where I'm at, it just allows me to take some chips off the table, pay off some commercial real estate. The clinic pays the real estate to lease. So I lease to myself. At this point, if I sold 90%, the new buyer would be leasing from me. So I'm really not losing any money. I'm actually gaining money. Now, if they own 90% and I own 10% and the business continues to scale, that 10% increases in value because now I'm using their money to buy more clinics. So I'm still scaling my business. I'm still growing my business. The worth is becoming more valuable because now they are buying clinics in Central Florida, buying clinics in Texas and Georgia. And I'm assisting them with that because they're using me as their primary ship. So all the other clinics will have my same electronic health record, will have my same voice, you know, VoIP phone. So they're just scaling their business off of mine. So this is another way to increase your value. And you're only going to be able to do this if you own your own business. And of course, you know, this is a success story. I'm not going to tell you, you know, the story when I got the new building. After working 9 hours, I was the one moving my patients' files to the new office, you know, because I needed to make sure that those files were done right. I'm not going to tell you how many times I had to hang out, you know, pictures on the wall because I didn't want to pay somebody to do that. I had my kids in the office painting. So there's a lot of those stories in there of business ownership, but I'm proud of those moments. I don't think you get that when you work for somebody else. And it is, it's tough, but then it starts to make sense and it becomes easier as you go on. But I would say being diversified really helps. I've always maintained privileges at various hospitals. I've always had a backup plan. As I told you, I was an ER physician. I don't have to be anymore, so I'm not. I admitted patients. I also worked at a nursing home. I've also done hospice. So I've kept my skills up in case of my business going down or something happening out of my control, that I'm still a physician with privileges at other locations, so I could support my family. As you stated, I have 5 kids. One's getting ready to graduate college. My other 4 children are in private school. So, you know, there's always that responsibility of having income coming in. And that's part of getting out of the ownership space and decreasing my chips. As you said, reimbursements are going down. You know, if you're forward thinking or you're coming into this space, you would have to say, well, based on your overhead, there may be a point where you're not making enough money to cover overhead. As a business entrepreneur, you're always growing. We do, you know, hair transplant, we do laser, you know, so you start adding business lines into your existing business to cover some of those decrease in reimbursements. You become more creative. And that's actually the fun of being a business owner. But going back to taking some chips off the table, it's different for everybody. I don't see our younger generation of physician being at the same clinic for 30 years like our forefathers were. So I think that was a good question you brought up. Like, when do I sell and who do I sell to? I think that's a good segue maybe for another podcast, because it is a a nervous process because you're basically giving up your baby or sharing your baby with somebody else.
Thank you, Dr. Diaz. I actually have a clinic that I have to go to.
Good deal.
But thank you so much. This is awesome.